Welcome, and thank you for listening to the Jizo An Zen Community's Dharma Talks. We are happy to make these recordings available to you. Please consider making a one-time or recurring donation via the link on our webpage found under Become a Member. We thank you wholeheartedly. Gassho.
Well, again, good evening, everyone.
Good evening, Sensei.
Hope you're doing well. So tonight's teaching is called the Heart Sutra, the Swiss Army Knife of Zen. And I think we all have heard that term before, you know, Swiss Army Knife. You know, it refers to, it's known for its ability to handle many different tasks. It has quite a few gadgets on it, you know. Similarly, the Heart Sutra can be viewed as a tool to help us see reality. It seeks to cut our dualistic thinking at the root so that we are more in touch with reality and not an illusion of it. Since we chant the Heart Sutra almost every time we meet here in the Zendo, it's important to discuss it every so often. And it's been some time since we've done that, actually a few years. The Heart Sutra, possibly the best known text of Mahayana Buddhism, is said to be the pure distillation of wisdom, prajna. The Heart Sutra is also among the shortest of sutras, and perhaps the most paradoxical. An English translation can easily be printed on one side of a piece of paper. And since it's relatively short, it's one of just a few that you can actually memorize. We say Heart Sutra, but the full name of the sutra is the Prajna Paramita Heart Sutra. And since we chant the Heart Sutra in Sino-Japanese, it is known as the Maka Hanya Paramita Shinyo Sutra. Either way, the full English title is The Perfection of the Heart of Wisdom. The Heart Sutra is part of the much larger Prajna Paramita writings, which is a collection of about 40 sutras composed between 100 BCE and 500 CE. The precise origin of the Heart Sutra is unknown. However, some scholars believe that Ananda may have played an important role. And Ananda was the Buddha's attendant. And it's reported that he had this vast recollection of the Buddha's teachings. In other words, he had a great memory, you know, to put it mildly. The Heart Sutra wouldn't have been known yet as the Heart Sutra since the Mahayana had not emerged as a movement in India until the first century. The earliest record of the Heart Sutra is a Chinese translation from Sanskrit, made between 200 and 250 CE. And as a result, there are some scholars that believe that the origin of the Heart Sutra is not India, but China. And we'll let the scholars sort that one out themselves. In the 8th century, another translation emerged that added an introduction and a conclusion. And this longer version was adopted by Tibetan Buddhism. In Zen and other Mahayana schools that originated in China, the shorter version is more common. Perhaps because of its brevity, the Heart Sutra is the most familiar of all the original teachings of the Buddha. The version of which we chant here in Jizoan Zendo comprises a mere 264 characters. And since the Sino-Japanese version lends itself well to chanting, it is recited daily at Zen monasteries and Zen centers around the world. As with most Buddhist scriptures, simply believing in what the Heart Sutra says is not the point. It's important also to appreciate that the sutra cannot be grasped by intellect alone. Although analysis is helpful, understanding only unfolds through experience. Or as Bodhidharma, the great 5th century Indian monk and founder of Zen noted, Zen is a special transmission outside the scriptures, no reliance on words and letters, and direct pointing to the human mind. In other words, from a Zen perspective, sutras are only guides and not a substitute for direct experience. According to some Buddhist scholars, the Heart Sutra was first delivered on Vulture Peak, which lies near the ancient Indian city of Rajagriha in northeast India, where the Buddha and his community of disciples stayed. Sutra means a Buddhist spiritual teaching, most often by the Buddha or derived from the teachings of the Buddha. And a sutra will often start out with the words, "Thus I have heard," which means a direct teaching from the Buddha. The Heart Sutra, however, is different, since it is based on a dialogue between Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion, and Shariputra, one of the Buddha's most accomplished disciples. So it's not a direct teaching of the Buddha. So let me go through a version of the Heart Sutra, and this is a translation by Thich Nhat Hanh. The Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara, while moving in deep course of perfect understanding, wisdom, shed light on the 5 skandhas and found them equally empty. After this penetration, she overcame ill-being. Listen, Shariputra, form is emptiness, and emptiness is form. Form is not other than emptiness. Emptiness is not other than form. The same is true with feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness. Listen, Shariputra, all dharmas are marked with emptiness. They are neither produced nor destroyed, neither defiled nor immaculate, neither increasing nor decreasing. Therefore, in emptiness, there is neither form nor feelings nor perceptions nor mental formation nor consciousness. No eye or ear or nose or tongue or body or mind. No form, no sound, no smell, no taste, no touch, no object of mind. No realms of elements, from eyes to mind consciousness. No interdependent origins, and no extinction of them. No ill-being, no cause of ill-being, no end of ill-being, and no path. No understanding, and no attainment. Because there is no attainment, the bodhisattvas, grounded in perfect understanding, wisdom, find no obstacles for their minds. Having no obstacles, they overcome fear, liberating themselves forever from illusion, realizing perfect nirvana, enlightenment. All Buddhas in the past, present, and future, thanks to this perfect understanding, arrive at full, right, and universal enlightenment. Therefore, one should know that perfect understanding is the highest mantra, the unequaled mantra, the destroyer of ill-being, the incorruptible truth. A mantra of Prajna Paramita should therefore be proclaimed. Gate, gate, paragate, parasamgati, Bodhisattva. Perfectly clear, I would presume. So let's start with the title of the Heart Sutra. Maka. Maka means big or great. Prajna means wisdom. And paramita means going beyond or perfecting. So this sutra is the great path for the perfection of wisdom, or prajna. The word maka in the title of the sutra points to something of very great size. So what might that be? You know, someone may say that the ground is pretty big. You know, it's on the whole planet. The oceans are big. The sky, space and sky together. You know, the Milky Way galaxy, the universe. The universe covers and surrounds our world and everything inside it. So it must be truly big. But the instant that you think of the universe, you have already covered the whole universe with your mind. Therefore, from a Buddhist perspective, our mind is bigger than the infinite time and infinite space of the universe. So the Heart Sutra points to this biggest thing, mind. Another way of looking at this is that awareness is boundless. The sutra shows how we can discover and cultivate the proper use of this biggest thing, our mind. That is why the sutra is called Maka. The perfection of wisdom refers to the wisdom that directly and intuitively understands the ultimate nature of phenomena. The Heart Sutra transcends all concepts and notions of reality. In the sutra, Avalokiteshvara answers with the profound words, "Form is emptiness, emptiness is form." She then proceeds to state the emptiness of the five aggregates, or skandhas, the emptiness of form, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness. These are the five aspects of existence that comprise a human being. This word emptiness can be somewhat problematic. The Buddhist notion of emptiness is often misunderstood as nihilism. However, the only thing that nihilism and the teachings of emptiness can be said to have in common is a skeptical outset. While nihilism concludes that reality is unknowable and that nothing meaningful can be communicated about the world, the Buddhist notion of emptiness arrives at just the opposite, namely that ultimate reality is knowable, that there is a clear-cut basis for phenomena, and that we can communicate and derive useful knowledge from it about the world. And the vehicle for this is wisdom and compassion. The Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara, while moving in deep course of perfect understanding, shed light on the five skandhas and found them equally empty. After this penetration, she overcame ill-being. And this word penetration is really important. What it means is to really see deeply, to see deeply at things. You know, again, as I had mentioned, this word emptiness can be somewhat confusing. But, you know, if I were to take this bell or picture it as a cup and fill it up with a liquid, you know, say water, right to the very last drop, you would say that it's full. And if I were to dump it out, all water out, then most people would say, well, now it's empty. But you always have to say empty of what? Because now it's full of air, you see. This thing that's, quote, now empty has more potential. It can accommodate more things, like our mind. It can hold a number of different liquids. It can hold a certain number of solids, peanuts, other things. So it has greater potential when it's empty. Avalokiteshvara states that the five skandhas are empty. The five skandhas, as I mentioned, can be viewed as the five aggregates that comprise a human being. These five aggregates are best viewed as five rivers flowing in every one of us. In fact, they are five rivers flowing together in us. the river of form, which means our bodies, the river of feelings, the river of perceptions, the river of mental formations, and the river of consciousness. They are always flowing, always changing. And the same can be said of everything that we perceive. This teaching bench is a good example when discussing emptiness. It is brown. It is solid. It weighs a few pounds. It looks like it could last a long time. I can lean on it. And it supports my weight. I can place books on it. But suppose I were to set this bench on fire and come back a few hours from now. The bench is no longer there. This thing that seems so solid and strong and real is now just a pile of ash that will blow around when we open up the back door. This example shows how the bench is empty. It is not a permanent thing. It's always changing, slowly being worn away with every use. It has no independent existence. In other words, if I were to take small pieces of this bench and put it under an electron microscope, we're not going to see many teaching benches. We're going to see a lot of other things, molecules and atoms and electrons if you go deeper. Over a long or short period of time, the bench will eventually change and become something other than what it appears. In our example of setting it on fire, what remains is ash and the production of heat. So this bench is complete emptiness, but though it always has a quality of emptiness, this emptiness at this very moment has form. A teaching bench. I can lean on it and it supports me. Form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. I'd like to share an experience of James Ishmael Ford, who's a Unitarian Universalist minister and also a Soto Zen priest, as it relates to emptiness. It was the end of our first Wisconsin winter. I glanced across the now greening grass at my old concrete Buddha statue, a statue given to my wife and me by a former congregation. I had lived with him for a number of years, and over the years had become very fond of him. But the rigors of winter had been too much for him. An enormous crack ran from the ground right up to his neck. It was a small disappointment, certainly not one of the terrible things that mark all our lives. Still, I felt the loss of something I'd come to be familiar with and quite fond of, and with which I associate many memories. Then I found myself reminded of something that Achan Cha, the great Theravadan meditation master, once said about a broken glass. One day, some people came to the master and asked, "How can you always be so happy in a world of constant change, constant impermanence, where you cannot protect your loved ones from harm, illness, and death?" The master held up a glass and said, "Someone gave me this glass, and I really like this glass. It holds my water admirably, and it glistens in the sunlight. I touch it, and it rings. One day, the wind may blow it off the shelf, or my elbow may knock it from the table. I know this glass is already broken, empty, so I enjoy it incredibly, incredibly today." Avalokiteshvara looked deeply into the five skandhas of form, feeling, perception, mental formations, and consciousness, and discovered that none of them can be by itself alone. Each can only exist in relationship to the others. So she tells us that form is empty. Form is empty of a separate self, but it is full of everything in the cosmos. The same is true with feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness. I'd like to share another reading. It's by Jack Kornfield. Jack Kornfield is the co-founder of the Insight Meditation Society in Massachusetts and the Spirit Rock Meditation Center in California. And this piece is from a collection of essays compiled in a book called Radiant Mind, Essential Buddhist Teachings and Texts. As we open and empty ourselves, we come to experience in interconnectedness the realization that all things are joined and conditioned in an interdependent arising. Each experience and event contains all others. The teacher depends on the student. The airplane depends on the sky. When a bell rings, is it the bell we hear, the air, the sound on our ears, or is it our brain that rings? It is all of these. As the Taoists say, the between is ringing. The sound of the bell is here to be heard everywhere, in the eyes of every person we meet, in every tree and insect, in every breath we take. When we truly sense this interconnectedness and the emptiness out of which all things arise, we find liberation and a spacious joy. Discovering emptiness brings a lightness of heart, flexibility, and an ease that rests in all things. The more solidly we grasp our identity in things, the more solid our problems become. Once I asked a delightful old Sri Lankan meditation master to teach me the essence of Buddhism. He just laughed at me and said three times, "No self, no problem. No self, no problem. No self, no problem." As I mentioned, in Buddhism, prajna means wisdom. But what about the word paramita of the Heart Sutra? The word paramita has two meanings, as I mentioned. One is perfection, and the other is going beyond. The Heart Sutra ends with the mantra gate gate paragate parasamgati bodhisvaha, as I had mentioned, which translates to gone, gone, gone beyond, altogether, beyond. Since we chant the Heart Sutra in Sino-Japanese, this mantra at the end of the Heart Sutra isn't so obvious to us. But if you were to look at the English version in our Blue Sutra book, you would see it clearly as a mantra. When you read Buddhist texts, going beyond implies that there is this shore and the other shore. This shore is the shore of suffering, and the other shore is the shore of liberation from suffering. So how do we get from the shore of suffering to the shore of liberation? The Buddhist masters tell us that when you know how to live skillfully on this shore, you already are on the other shore, or the shore of liberation from suffering. And this is where the prajna paramitas come in. It is the wisdom of living in a world of duality and language, and understanding this duality and the limits of language at a much deeper level. There are six aspects of the prajna paramitas, and you will typically hear these aspects simply as the six paramitas. But it's always important to emphasize the word prajna in reference to the Heart Sutra, because without it, we can lose the connection of the paramitas to the Heart Sutra. The six prajna paramitas or perfections are generosity, discipline, patience, joyful effort, meditation, and wisdom. The six prajna paramitas are important because they take what is expressed in the Heart Sutra and make it accessible so that the Heart Sutra can be put into practice. And let's face it, the Heart Sutra can seem a little esoteric and hard to see the relevance from a practical perspective. I'd like to share one last reading, and this is by Roshi Joan Halifax of the Upaya Zen Center. And it's called The Heart Sutra's Boundless Vision. Until the arising of the Heart Sutra, Buddhist practitioners typically relied on the presence of an external teacher, a particular Buddha, to show them the way. The Heart Sutra, however, pointed to an approach that was revolutionary, one that directs us towards the mind. I have translated the Sanskrit term shunyata, which is commonly translated as emptiness in English, to boundlessness. This points to a mind that cannot be captured, described, or limited, a mind embedded in the boundlessness of the present, the sutra of all sutras. Even though boundlessness may seem to have no qualities, it has some characteristics that form a basis for our practice, allowing or encouraging us to let go, to transform our grasping into open-handedness. The first characteristic of boundlessness that meets us in practice is not knowing. The boundless mind is free of ideas, opinions, conceptions. It is fresh, open, unmediated. The second aspect of groundlessness, wisdom, beyond wisdom, is not grounded in anything at all. All is seen as impermanent, ever-changing, not fixed in time or space. Awakening is a mystery that cannot be arrived at through reasoning and discursive mind. Reference points and preferences are discovered to be rooted in fear, the need of the small self to become more solid, more grounded. A third aspect of boundlessness is immediacy, our present situation. We cannot explain it. No scientist can unfold it for us. Yet each moment is the repository of the past, present, and future. All the sutras are contained herein. This experience of immediacy is our boundless original dwelling place, the realization of wisdom beyond wisdom. A fourth characteristic of boundlessness is its expression in interconnectedness, the endless connections that flow through our very lives. In this present moment, nothing is missing. We are all here. Our tendency to discriminate, cut, and parse our experience might seem to make us more secure, but we cut ourselves away from who we really are, a self that is coextensive with all beings, all things. The Heart Sutra affirms that this boundless mind is Buddha, none other than Buddha. It is a mind that is everywhere and nowhere. It is a mind that is both timeless and in the embrace of this moment. It belongs to no one and to everyone, and it is a bond of vastness that brings all beings into unity. Our ultimate teacher is this boundless mind embedded in all beings and in all things. So in summary, the Dharma speaks of freedom and emptiness. Emptiness isn't nothingness, it's spaciousness. And spaciousness isn't empty, It's full of possibility, or boundless possibilities. Without the constant clutter of thoughts and desires, there is room for something deeper to emerge. This moment. Letting go doesn't mean losing. It means making room. It means trusting that what we release will be replaced not by nothing, but by freedom of mind. So here's a question for tonight. There are beings in this world that have experienced this vast awareness, this boundlessness. Who are they?